That's the great Hank Crawford on alto sax with One Mint Julep, recorded in 1986. Jimmy McGriff on organ, Jim Pittsburgh on guitar, and Bernard Purdy on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, February the 27th, and two subjects we'll be dealing with today. Jurors are judges of the facts in the case, and should understand and exercise their power in the interest of justice, says our guest in the second half of the program. But first, a very scary downside, especially for low-income and poorer Americans, to the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. The downside, estate recovery. Our guest, noted economist and former editor of the Wall Street Journal, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, joins us to discuss a very, very serious issue that many low-income and poorer Americans will forfeit their homes and other assets that they may have to the state in order to cover the cost of their medical care. Dr. Roberts has had careers in scholarship and academia, journalism, public service, and business. He is chairman of the Institute for Political Economy. He's one of the most respected columnists in alternative media. His articles appearing on news websites, including Lou Rockwell, InfoWars, Counterpunch, Information Clearinghouse, and many others. He has written several books, I think at least a dozen, perhaps more by now, including The Tyranny of Good Intentions and How the Economy Was Lost. Thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm pleased to be with you.
Well, could you tell us why, in your view, this is what's going to happen, that poorer and low-income Americans are particularly at risk of losing their assets?
Yeah, those who have any.
Yes.
will lose them. What Obamacare does, since it's based on privatizing health care and relying on premiums paid to private insurance companies, obviously, the really poor can't even afford a subsidized premium, and they wouldn't be able to manage under Obamacare. So what Obamacare does is it takes everyone whose income is less than 138% of the federal poverty level and puts them into Medicaid. Now, when Medicaid was set up initially, the law specifies that if you have any assets and you receive health care under Medicaid. When you die, those assets are inherited by the government to cover the cost of your health care. That was not changed when Obamacare was written. So that provision remains in the law. So it means, you know, one of the things that some poor families have is a place to live. They have a family home. And it may be holding three generations. It may be grandparents, parents, and grandchildren. And the home sort of is a support system for them, provides them with a place to live. They don't have to pay rent. Sometimes families have a bit of other assets. But generally, it's a family home. And so under Obamacare, if you are with an income below 138%, the federal poverty level, and you have some assets, then those assets are claimed by the state. So what this shows is that the compassionate rhetoric that the Obama people used to sell this was a lie, because the poorest people are the ones who have to pay the most. Only the poor have to give up their assets. If you have a subsidized policy, and you're allowed to have a subsidized policy within the income range of 138% above, you know, and up of the federal poverty level, all the way up to 400%, or four times the federal poverty level, you can receive a subsidy for the payment of your private premium. The subsidy declines as your income rises between 138% and 400% of the poverty level. But the people who receive these subsidies do not have to repay for their health care by giving up their estates or whatever part of them the health care costs can claim. So it is an example of law that does not follow the 14th Amendment of equal protection. It's discriminatory. Some people are treated one way by Obamacare, other people another way. There's also age discrimination in it, because the way it works under this Medicare provision of estate recovery, if you take Medicare benefits, say, when you're 45 years old, you don't have to repay them unless it's long-term care. They put you in a nursing home or something. But once you're, I can't remember if it's 54 or 55, one of those
it's 55.
Two numbers,
you, yeah.
55, you reach that age and you're on Medicaid, then you do have to give up your estate. So the Medicaid provision of Obamacare takes your estate if you are on long-term care, regardless of age, or if once you reach 55 to 64, before you qualify for Medicare, and you use Medicaid in that range, then your estate is subject to recovery to cover those costs. So it's a really deceitful practice. It would have been considered unconstitutional prior to the 1930s. And it certainly discriminates on the basis of age, which I think is still unconstitutional in the United States because of the Supreme Court rulings. So that's the outline of the picture.
Why is this not generally known? is this part of the fine print that is hidden someplace that people don't see? Or how is it that what you're saying to me now is just almost like a revelation?
Well, you wouldn't want to reveal that if you're telling everyone that this is the Affordable Health Care Act and that it's designed to help the worst off and the poorest people. You wouldn't want to say, and by the way, we'll steal your house. So it's inconsistent. The fact is inconsistent with the sales job. But this is true of everything that has happened, at least since the Clinton administration. The sales job given for attacking Serbia was a total lie. The sales job that George W. Bush gave for attacking Iraq and Afghanistan were total lies. The sales job that Obama gave for attacking Libya is a total lie. They lied about poison gas being used by the Assad government in Syria. They lie about Iran. They lie about the Ukraine. So why is anyone surprised they lie about Obamacare? What don't they lie about? Try to find one thing that the Obama, we've had two terms, practically, two terms of Bush, two terms of Clinton. What didn't they lie about? I challenge you to find one issue, one thing.
Is there anybody who has raised this issue about the fact that poorer Americans and poor Americans who have just perhaps, like you said, it is true that for many, a home, however modest it might be, is still the shared asset for perhaps sometimes many generations. And if a family is to incur this kind of a penalty because of a mandated requirement that they must have medical care, even if they must take on this risk as well. Shouldn't this be part of shouldn't somebody have to sign off on these things and say, well, let's discuss the legal ramifications? It's a kind of debt obligation on top of death. You'd also now have debt obligations even after you die. Shouldn't this have been a major discussion and something that the public should know about, certainly for those who are enrolling in Obamacare?
Well, that's the main point of the article that's posted on my site around the beginning of February, first part of February. There's a long article there about estate recovery that deals with all these aspects. It was signed off on by the Obama regime, by the Congress. The media, that is the prostitute media, has not bothered to tell people. But the article that's on my site describes in great detail the situation. And you raise another issue that is important, because the people who sign up for the Medicare version are not told. It's not on the application that they sign that by accepting medical treatment under Medicaid, they are subject to estate recovery. It's simply not on the application. I believe there are two or three states that put it on their application. I think Massachusetts, I think Washington and Oregon. It is not on the federal application or on the federal website. And most states don't bother to tell because it's a deterrent to signing up. And they want everybody signed up. And the reason for it, again, is that since Obamacare was written by the private insurance companies and a few right-wing think tanks. And it was written for the benefit of the profits of the insurance companies, not for the health care of American people. Since that is the purpose of it, they have to get rid of the poorer people who cannot afford, as I said, even a subsidized premium. And so they herd them into Medicaid. A lot of them, I think, are being signed up even without their knowledge, because the assumption made by the Obama regime is that if you're on food stamps, for example, that you are below the 138% of the poverty level, and therefore they just automatically sign up the people who are on the food stamp rolls. They have other ways of doing this. Now, whether they're able to completely sign them up without their signature, I'm not sure. But I do know that they go through, for example, the food stamp rolls, and will send everybody a notice that, oh, look, sign this and you'll have Medicare protection. They do not appear to tell the people when they send that notice that, and by the way, if you have any assets, we'll take them at your death. So there's a huge deception going on, and you would think, as you imply, that there would be a big uproar about this mass deception of the poorest and most vulnerable people. But there isn't. There's no uproar. I think that the information was first made available on my site at the beginning of this month. So you can see how totally uninformed people are, including all of the Obama people who are out pushing this Obamacare and defending it from Republicans. I mean, the Republicans aren't attacking it for the right reason. The Republicans are so stupid as to call it socialized medicine. Well, it's not. It's privatized medicine in which there are taxpayer subsidies to pay premiums to private insurance companies. So the whole thing is outrageous. I mean, it's not just the estate recovery that's outrageous. The whole thing is outrageous. Now, I blame both parties for it. I blame the Republicans because when the Democrats were talking of a single-payer system, which is what the United States needs, it's what every developed, civilized country has, it would dramatically lower the cost and simply cover everybody. There wouldn't be any more of this. But the Republicans said, oh, we can't have it, socialized medicine. So instead of fighting them, the Democrats went to the insurance lobby and said, you write a bill that you can lobby through Congress because we need a victory. We just want a victory. Obama's got to achieve something that we can have a headline about. So you go write the bill, and then we'll rely on your lobby capability to get it passed the Republicans, and it's your bill. And that's what happened. So the insurance industries wrote this to maximize their profits. And all of the promises Obama made were false. You know, he said you could keep your current policy if you had one. Your rates won't change. Well, of course, millions of people have gotten notices from their insurance companies that their rates are going to double. And it appears, and this is so absurd, it's hard to believe, it appears the reason all the rates double is that it's written into Obamacare that everyone has to be covered for everything. For example, men have to be covered for pregnancy, for female contraception, for abortion. So all kinds of people are forced to pay premiums for things that have nothing to do with them. A 55-year-old woman is not going to have any kids, but she's got to have pregnancy coverage, abortion coverage. So why is that in there? Well, because that's what doubled the premiums for everybody who was already insured under private medical policies. It's the insurance companies. And they were given by the Obama regime a green light just to loot. And that's what they did. That's what Obamacare does. It loots everyone. It's not just the very poor who lose their estate if they have any, but it's also the people who had private policies. Their premiums have gone way up. So this is a situation that I don't understand how anyone can defend. And I don't know why people aren't in the streets. I really don't know why there's not massive protest or massive recall movements, because the people are being looted.
I'm still stuck with this, the seminal idea that the government has the right not only to mandate something of you that usually is considered, an individual choice, but also to mandate that you assume and that you take on a debt that, if I understand the laws of probate laws correctly, even when you die, your debt may not necessarily be retired with your death. It may go on to another generation or other people who are connected to you, who now are responsible for your debt. So I'm wondering why, just like you, I mean, your website was the first place that I saw this, about this idea that you take on a debt, because when you sign up, part of the process is to agree to the terms of the contract. So the government imposes a contract on the consumer and also imposes obligations on the consumer that the consumer doesn't know anything about. Now, in any other sphere, this would be considered, really bad. This is
illegal.
Actionable and illegal.
No, you're exactly right.
And I don't get this at all.
Well, maybe because you expect too much from government, or you have old-fashioned ideas about people in office being honest and responsible and caring about the public. And there's nobody like that in Washington. And this was a law written by private companies for their benefit. And that's what it is. And that's why it has all these adverse effects for everyone in the country. The only people who come out under Obamacare are the very poor who have nothing. Nothing at all. So there's no estate recovery on them. And they don't come out either, because the level of care they get is so poor. In fact, what you see is the medical practice refusing Medicaid patients. In fact, it's now very hard even for Medicare patients to find doctors. Many doctors, many medical practices simply do not accept Medicare patients. Well, the reimbursements on Medicaid are even poorer. So it basically doesn't really help the worst off who have nothing, because the quality of the care they get is so poor. So all of this could have been avoided except for the atavistic ideology of the Republican Party. And, of course, I say that as a former Republican presidential appointee. This ideology that, we can't possibly let the government help anybody.
We should... I want to discuss something a minute, just tacking on to your appointment as a presidential appointee, you said you were in the Reagan administration in the Treasury Department.
Right.
How do you, looking at it from that point on to here, where we are on a historical level, what really suffices? What is the economic theory that informs policymaking in Washington? What is it? I don't get it.
Well, I think since Clinton, it's whatever benefits the rich. Ever since Clinton, we've seen the concentration of American business. For example, Clinton allowed five or six mega media companies to buy up the entire independent U.S. media. So there are no longer any independent newspapers, independent radio stations, independent TV stations. All of this is concentrated in the hands of five or six companies. What else happened under Clinton? They repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated commercial from investment banking and made it impossible for bankers to gamble on the basis of the equity of their depositors' accounts. So when you repeal Glass-Steagall, you allow massive concentration in the financial sector. So banks, once you had investment banks, you had other banks, commercial banks, and now the banks are both. And not only that, other deregulation allowed banks to buy up other banks, so that we now have four banks in the United States, the size of which exceeds the gross domestic product of most countries. And this is why they're said to be too big to fail. Well, anytime you allow this type of massive concentration, you are making it possible for the people who control those mega firms to just exploit the economy ruthlessly and individuals ruthlessly. And that's what we have seen. So, and of course, everything else has been concentrated. What people don't understand is that the banks today, they're not just banks. They own shipping fleets. They own huge stockpiles of oil, of metals, of aluminum, all kinds of commodities. They in fact can control prices in most of the commodity markets. They're everywhere. They own all kinds of industries and things. If you look at their books, and this is publicly known, I'm not telling you anything you can't Google and find out on the internet. So, in other words, we've got a form of monopoly capitalism that you couldn't even dream up in textbooks. It's so vast. And it's unbelievable because we have on the books all these laws against economic concentration, antitrust laws, and yet the Clinton, Bush, and Obama regimes have allowed these massive concentrations, all of which are illegal according to laws on the books. And nothing is done about it. And even after it results in the financial crisis, which we're still suffering, you know, the Federal Reserve is still printing $65 billion per month to keep the banks afloat. All of this is destroying the dollar. Sooner or later, we'll pay a high price, either in the collapse of the dollar's exchange value or in domestic inflation because of the bailout of four banks. So the economic policy of the United States is directed at the current time to keeping four banks afloat and to benefiting the rich. And that's why you have seen in the last 20 years the massive inequality in the distribution of income and wealth in the United States. It's now worse than many of the third world countries that are essentially kleptocracies. The distribution of income in the United States, you can look it up on the internet. It's horrendous. It's so bad. And there's nothing like it ever been seen in developed or civilized countries. So the wealth and the income is now concentrated in fewer and fewer and fewer hands.
Dr. Roberts, I just want to thank you so much.
There are 85 people in the world, 85, whose wealth exceeds that of half of the world's population.
I want to thank you so much for this discussion today. I'd like to come back and have you do a tutorial for us on economics, the way we ought to understand it. But it is a vital service that you have pointed out this particular aspect of Obamacare, that it is, in fact, it carries the obligation of debt, and people need to know that they are agreeing to take on that debt, that they give the government permission to, if they have any money left, to basically seize it, to place liens on their bank accounts in order to get it. And this is being done without anybody knowing, really, publicly. This is not a public discussion. So I thank you for the service of bringing this to public attention. As I said, yours was the first, your website was the first place that I even saw any mention of this, and that's why we needed to engage in this discussion today. And I really want to thank you for being available, and we'll continue the discussion on an economic note at a later date. But thank you so much for being with us today.
Yes, well, you're certainly welcome, and I appreciate your interest and would be pleased to again be on your program.
Thank you so much. We'll take this break, a very short break, while we connect with our guest for the second segment right after this. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I want you to remember that, both things, Lead Stories and PRN.FM. Just to reinforce the point, that is a huge revelation about Obamacare that is not in the general circulation, and people are not understanding that this bill, this law, I keep calling it a bill, it's a law, it's the law, after all, he said. It's something that we really need to appreciate. There's a lot about it that we don't know. Well, our guest says that jurors have particular rights that they also are not informed about. As a juror, you have the right to disregard or to set aside laws when you contemplate a verdict that just don't make sense to you, or that in your mind is unjust. Have you been told that? There's this push going on now from this organization, of whom our guest is executive director, and it is about informing the public, those people who are likely to be called up for jury duty, to let you know that as a juror, you're not supposed to just sit there in the courtroom and operate mechanically, that you do have you do have power, you do have the ability to act literally as a judge of the facts yourself. Kirsten Tynan is Executive Director of the Fully Informed Jury Association. She joins us now from Helena, Montana. Hello, Kirsten. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks a lot. Now, what is this association about? What are you trying to accomplish with the Fully Informed Jury Association?
The Fully Informed Jury Association is a nonprofit educational outreach organization dedicated to informing everyone of the juror's right and responsibility to disregard the law when a just verdict requires it and vote not guilty, even if the law has technically been broken. And cases where they might want to do this include situations where the law itself is inherently unjust. Perhaps the law is generally good, but in the case at hand, it's unjustly applied. Perhaps the penalty at which for which the offense is given is excessive compared to the size of the offense. So for any of those reasons and many others, people should vote not guilty.
Wow, that's a very, very radical concept. But in my little research that I've been doing, it is not a new concept. Could you talk about that?
It's definitely not a new concept. It actually dates back hundreds of years. The most well-known case is the case of William Penn in 1670, who violated England's Conventicle Act by preaching the Quaker religion publicly, which was at the time illegal. And his jury refused to convict him, even though they were A, directed to do so by the judge in the case, and B, they were even imprisoned and withheld food and water from them in order to coerce them into changing their verdict, and they wouldn't. And since then, that has been enshrined not only in common law, but it came over through the colonies and became a part of our legal system today and has been used in American history many times. Two notable situations, helped open the door for the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment when Fugitive Slave Act cases were nullified en masse. And also we have the repeal of prohibition, largely thanks in part to jury nullification because people were simply refusing to convict their neighbors for these victimless alcohol violations.
Now, I want to just deal with that term, jury nullification. That's what it's called officially, jury nullification. And I'm reading now directly from the Fully Informed Jury Association's website, and this is what it says. The primary function of the independent juror is not, as many may think, to dispense punishment to fellow citizens accused of breaking various laws, but rather to protect fellow citizens from tyrannical abuses of power by government. The Constitution guarantees you the right to trial by jury. This means that government must bring its case before a jury of the people if government wants to deprive any person of life, liberty, or property. Jurors can say no to government tyranny by refusing to convict. That's very powerful stuff, but at the same time, it is loaded with buzzwords that suggest this might be, is this a reactionary movement? Is this a movement that says, look, is it like saying, we the people, anything that we don't like, we can construe to be against our wishes, and therefore, if we sit on a jury, it's our job, as a reflex action almost, to react to the wishes of the prosecutor who says, well, we want you to convict this person, and mm-hmm. we should say no?
Well, prosecutors have a huge amount of nullification power themselves. And so jury nullification is a way to balance that out. And what I mean by that is that prosecutors, often they can adjudicate cases without ever the case going before a judge or the jury through a plea bargain. They can agree to drop charges, i.e. not enforce laws that they claim have been broken, in exchange for the person who is accused pleading guilty. They also have the power to decide what they're going to charge them with, and many times we're seeing prosecutors stacking up extra charges in an effort to bully people into taking plea bargains, and including charges that have really harsh mandatory minimums. And so if a prosecutor gets a plea deal in which there's a mandatory minimum, basically they have not only decided what to charge the person with, but if that person pleads pleads guilty and takes the plea bargain because they're afraid to, you know, risk even more and worse charges, they have essentially adjudicated the entire case. It's not going before a jury. So jury nullification is really a way to balance out that excessive power that prosecutors have today. And if we have as jurors, you know, make clear that there are certain types of unjust laws that we're simply not going to be complicit in enforcing, then we're going to see prosecutors stop bringing those kind of cases. We're going to see police stop arresting people for those kind of offenses. And I think we all know that even though the laws are officially written to apply equally to everyone, the way we are seeing them enforced is clearly and measurably not equal. And you see many states, if you look at the Sentencing Project's website, there are many states you can look and see people of color are being prosecuted, arrested, convicted many times more than white people for crimes I'm going to call them offenses, not crimes, for offenses which we all, you know, roughly equally commit at the same rate. And so jury nullification is a way to give defendants confidence that if they do go before a jury of their peers, the prosecutor is not just going to have their wishes rubber stamped by the jury, but that the jury will independently look at all of those charges and consider what not only is legal, but what is just.
Poppy Sidhu is one of three defendants who soon will come before the court on cannabis charges, marijuana possession charges, and it's a pretty serious case. Poppy, tell us about this case.
So March of 2012, here in Washington State, for the last 15 years, we have current medical marijuana laws. We were operating a medical marijuana access point for patients of Whatcom County in Bellingham, Washington, and we were raided March of 2012. As the raid happened, they arrested myself, the owner, and the manager, and we are currently awaiting trial. We are looking at about 6 to 7 drug felony charges with a minimum of 30 years.
It's a very serious case.
Yes,
but
it is.
How does jury nullification fit in your case?
So here in the state of Washington, the voters in 2012, they passed Initiative 502, and that had legalized recreational marijuana. And currently the laws or the charges that we're being pressed against have to deal with medical marijuana laws. And so right now, citizens of Washington State are kind of in a, difficult situation because right now the city of Bellingham is prosecuting medical marijuana patients, yet the state has legalized marijuana. And so when it comes to jury rights and jury nullification, we've been doing outreach in Bellingham, Washington, in regards of teaching the citizens about their laws, teaching them about what happens when you get called to jury duty. A lot of people just get a letter in the mail for jury duty. They go in, you watch a half-hour video, and then you're basically, the fate of this defendant is in their hands. And a lot of them aren't sure what's going on. So at least with medical cannabis, if people are disagreeing with the state law, you know, if they believe that they disagree with it or it's unjust or they believe it's immoral or wrongly applied in this case in a state that has legalized marijuana, it applies to it. And, you know, it just takes one person to say, hey, hold on. Washington State just legalized marijuana. Why are we prosecuting people for marijuana? It just doesn't make sense. And they can say not guilty. And it's just like one person has that power out of the whole jury to turn a case around. So jury nullification does play really heavily into my case because we do plan on taking it to trial.
So in your view, basically the outcome for you and the other two people similarly in the same situation would rest on jurors having some awareness that they don't necessarily have to go with a straight cut and dried presentation in the court by the prosecutor, who more than likely would ask that you be convicted and sent away for up to 30 years, which is what you say you're facing, that somehow they would be able to take advantage of their own view of this thing, since, as you pointed out, there is a dichotomy here that you are charged with a crime that is not illegal if it were to be applied as with medical marijuana. So there's a confusion. The state itself has two different ways of interpreting the same thing.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting. And, you know, my case isn't the only one that's going on. And it's kind of almost my duty as an activist to do this jury rights outreach, to teach people about jury nullification, to teach them what to do when you get called to a jury, to know your laws, to ask the questions that you need to ask before prosecuting someone. And it's just like, you know, my fate almost relies on that. But it's up to the citizens of Washington State and across the nation to know their rights. And in the courtroom, I can't speak about jury nullification. My attorney can't speak about jury nullification. He'd be contempt to the court. And so it's kind of, you know, it's almost our given right as an American citizen, and it's our job to kind of teach people what their rights are.
Kirsten, I've never heard of a case in which a judge instructs the jury while, you know, giving them instructions about the charges that they should consider, that the judge also would instruct a jury about its right to disregard everything he just said while reading instructions to the jury, and they can also choose. Part of the choice that they can make is they can go their own way.
Yes, it's very unusual. That would not typically happen. The only place right now where it has any sort of likelihood of happening is New Hampshire, because New Hampshire has a special jury nullification statute that they passed in 2012. But almost anywhere else, if you don't know your rights before you go into the courthouse, you are not going to be informed about them accurately once you get inside. And in fact, you will likely be misinformed about them. So that is why an organization such as FIJA exists, because that is really the only way people are going to learn about their rights, is to find out before they get in there. And just to let everyone know, if you have any more questions on this, you can give us a call at 1-800-TELJURY for a free jury rights, jury power information kit, and get more information on that.
I want to ask you about the downside of jury nullification. Suppose you have a jury that, for all intents and purposes, in terms of culture or racial or ethnic background or class designation, whatever, for whatever the reason, they would have more in common with each other than with the defendant. And if, in fact, they were to exercise their rights under jury nullification, they would, in fact, be a greater danger to the defendant getting some kind of justice in the court. I could think, for example, in the case that we've seen a lot of cases recently where the jury makeup itself is against the defendant, and probably the fate of the case, the outcome of the case, really would rest as in the hands of the defense attorney more so than if all of the jurors sat down in a room and came to the same conclusion that is opposite what the defense wants. Couldn't jury nullification have an opposite effect as well?
So the playing field is not even in that regard. It is tilted in favor of not guilty in this way. In most places, with the exceptions of Oregon and Louisiana, a single person voting not guilty can hang the jury, i.e., that they will not get a conviction. It could be retried. In many cases, they're not, simply because they realize it's not cost effective to try again when they didn't have a clear case to begin with. But on the other hand, there is no place in the United States where a single person voting guilty can convict the defendant. In almost every state and all federal courts, you need 12 guilty votes to convict the defendant. and in the two exceptions being Oregon and Louisiana, where you can convict with 9 or 10. But in those cases, you have a much harder time getting enough people to vote guilty. So it is definitely tilted in favor of the defendant. And we do that purposely because our system is founded on the idea that it is better to let 10 guilty people go free rather than to convict one person wrongly.
Poppy, I want to come back to you because, you sound very calm considering the situation that you're facing. It's a very serious situation.
It is.
Yeah. How are you coping?
Well, to be honest, any person that, is going into their volunteer position and has a police task force come in with guns to your head, basically, and you don't know if you're going to make it or if this is it. I mean, it was pretty traumatizing. And then they put me in jail. And at the time, I'm a sociology major, and I was going full-time school. I was a CNA with a gentleman that had MS. And I was also a volunteer at this access point. And so it kind of turned my life completely around. I lost my financial aid. I'm still waiting for trial to happen so I can go back to school. I suffer from PTSD just because of the traumatic events that happened during the raid and being put into jail. I've kind of been treated like a criminal. And, I'm a young East Indian woman. It's living in America, and it's just I've never felt this way. And, even getting a job right now, the fact that I have, I'm pending drug felonies, they look at me like I'm some type of drug dealer or some type of, criminal. And it's just like the people that do listen, I'm out in Bellingham teaching people about jury rights and jury nullification. I can't talk about my case, but I can talk about what they can do to help other people when they get called to jury duty. So I guess this outreach and being an activist is kind of keeping me kind of positive during all of this. But I won't lie to you, I'm still a really nervous wreck. It's a very interesting state that we're in.
Mm-hmm. Christian, I've read quite a bit about the application or how this jury nullification issue has arisen in the courts. And oddly enough, I find an overabundance of such cases as the one confronting Poppy Sidhu, where we have cannabis, the drug war, if you will, being the testing ground for a lot of these cases. Is there a reason why it seems to have been so predominant so far in these particular kinds of cases?
Well, I think the idea that if there is no victim, there is no crime really resonates with people. That's something that we inherently understand, most of us anyway. And the fact is that many of these drug war cases involve possession, they involve sale to someone who sought it out voluntarily. We see ridiculous charges about drug paraphernalia, and it turns out to be a Ziploc bag that touched the drugs. I mean, it's just so ridiculously out of control and excessive for things that have not harmed anybody, victimless offenses, that I think people understand kind of intuitively that we've been doing something very, very wrong for the last 40 years. And I think we're coming to a point where people understand that we need to get that corrected. We have people who are in prison for life without parole for, victimless offenses. That's just insane. That's just nuts.
And jury nullification would, in a way, return some degree of justice or sanity in the courtroom, in your view?
I think so. I think we understand that not only, are we prosecuting people for victimless offenses, but we're not even doing so in some kind of even-handed manner. Far and away, people of color are harassed more by police, are prosecuted more, are convicted more often, are sentenced more harshly for completely victimless offenses. And I think we as a society need to understand that we cannot be doing that and have a peaceful world. We need to treat everyone justly, and jury nullification is a great way to start getting that under control.
All right. So, again, how do people learn a bit more about this process of jury nullification?
Mm-hmm. Please visit our website, which is FIJA for Fully Informed Jury Association.org, or we will send you out a free jury power information kit if you leave your name and address at 1-800-TELJURY, 1-800-TELJURY.
Well, Poppy, I wish you the very best of luck. I really mean that. And when is your trial?
We are hoping to go to trial in April. That's not for sure yet. The prosecutor has been pushing this thing out for the last 2 years. So I'm just, you know, I just wait for that call from my attorney. So we're looking for April. If not, we will try to keep everyone updated.
Well, we take a look and see whether, in fact, jury nullification does become a factor in your trial, and if so, how it influenced the end of the trial. That's how we will take a look at that. Thanks so much
for being with us today.
And
thank
Kirsten,
you.
Thank you so much also for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Thank you. Well, that brings us close to the end of our program today. Two ideas that I think are worth considering. Of course, jury nullification is quite controversial, but we'll proceed with other discussions about it. But it is interesting to know that as jurors, we not just bumps on a log sitting in a chair and waiting for the instructions to deliver a predictable result. We are thinking human beings, and we have rights. And one of those rights in the court of law is this business of jury nullification. I also wanted you to know that this issue of Obamacare and this thing about, it stunned me when I read it. And you should get to know some more about it as well. The guest was Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. You can visit his website and get more information. The article is right there. Very much recommend that you take advantage of reading it. Okay, so thanks a lot. By the way, the last thing I want to remind you about is our famous full open forum. It is now going to be on Fridays. That's right. So we have gotten enough information from and reaction from listeners to say, okay, switch it to Fridays, and we'll have, therefore, our first Friday next month will be our first Friday schedule. Thanks so much for being with me today. I really do appreciate it. You can talk to me, of course. Send me a note at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Keep it right here. Coming up next is Mike Fader with Occupied Territory, America. And see you tomorrow. Thanks so much.